Saudi Arabia had long known that it had a weakness: food. Seeking to end its dependency on food imports, Saudi Arabia in 1980 embarked on a massive self-sufficiency program fueled by oil money and fossil water. That program eventually focused on a single water-thirsty crop, wheat, and things got a bit out of control. In the mid-1980s and early 1990s, Saudi Arabia pumped more groundwater than oil, and 5% of the entire 1991 Saudi budget was being spent on growing more wheat than anyone can eat. In today's video, a noble policy with long-running water consequences. In 1970, Saudi Arabia had an estimated population of about 5.8 million people. The country imported over half of its food for those people, a long-running situation. Back in 1959, the government started subsidizing those imports to keep food affordable and minimize social unrest. However, the population was growing rapidly. In the 20 years after 1970, the Saudi population expanded at over 3.5% a year. By 1992, the population hit 16.4 million, many of whom are expatriate workers. The population was not only growing, it was also getting richer. And richer people want to eat nicer, more expensive foods like meat and dairy. Such demands strained the food import situation even more, since Saudi Arabia would otherwise have to grow lots of grass to feed those animals. A country dependent on imports is beholden to the export market, and so takes on several risks. Like if food production in the exporting countries falls short in a particular growing season, they might be forced to prioritize domestic demand. And if several countries are affected, then the repercussions can get serious. For example, in a prior video, I covered the rice crisis of 2007-2008, when storms and bad growing seasons triggered a chain reaction across Asia, with higher prices, shortages, and food riots. A similar event occurred in 1972-1974. Oil is one of the key inputs for food production and transportation. So when oil prices shot up because of the crisis, so did the prices of wheat, corn, and rice, most by 50 to 90%, but rice increased over 200%. Global turmoil due to geopolitical events can affect food transport networks. The world wars threatened the assorted Gulf states with famine. For World War II, food supplies only came through thanks to the efforts of wartime organizations like the Allied Middle East Supply Center. There was another dynamic at play. The oil embargoes of the 1970s showed the Arab nations that their natural resources can be wielded as political weapons of influence. But the Saudis quickly realized that their food import dependencies can be turned against them too. In 1974, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Earl Butz, whose nickname was Rusty, said that, quote, "food is a weapon," end quote, and, quote, "the most powerful tool," end quote, in the negotiating kit, based on remarks told to him by Henry Kissinger. Now, the context was that Rusty Butz was talking up a bunch of farmers in Manawa, Wisconsin. But the belief did seem to exist within the U.S. government that food embargoes can be leveraged against certain countries that did not follow the line. So far as I can tell from the reading, Kissinger and the U.S. government never attempted to ban food exports to Saudi Arabia so that they can get cheaper oil, but they did offer food aid as incentives to get Arab nations to negotiate with Israel. The answer to all of these concerns is food self-sufficiency. But can desert-heavy Saudi Arabia possibly ever grow all of its own food? Saudi Arabia is one of the world's most arid countries. I mentioned that in a prior video, but it's common sense. It's hot there. On average, the country gets between 50 to 100 millimeters of rain per year, all of it falling in the months between November and April. On the whole, the rain is quite irregular. Even when it does rain, the dry, desert-like climate ensures that any rainwater that gets onto the ground quickly evaporates back up into the sky. For this reason, Saudi Arabia does not have a perennial river or lake. Less than 2% of its land is arable. Moreover, only a small portion of that actually gets cultivated due to inadequacies in water, transportation, and infrastructure. Perhaps the most significant agricultural area in Saudi Arabia is in the southwest Asir Mountains. The region receives regular heavy rains between March and October and is quite green, with dates, grains, and cotton growing on terraced farms on the mountainsides. Based on the pictures, you would not think you're looking at Saudi Arabia. The dry desert sands, however, hides a bonanza of water underneath. Beneath Saudi Arabia's northern and eastern regions, covering two-thirds of the country's total area, are massive fossil aquifers. These are limestone and sandstone formations, 150 to 1,500 meters deep and 300 meters thick. The aquifer system is very complicated, with multiple layers of principal and secondary aquifers. 86% of all the groundwater is stored in the system's 8 principal aquifers. Why do we call them fossil? Well, because they are tens of thousands of years old. These water resources were created between 10,000 to 32,000 years ago during the last ice age, when Saudi Arabia's rainfall patterns were much different. In absolute terms, these aquifers are massive. The issue is that due to the weather and heat, these aquifers do not easily recharge. The shallow aquifers do appear to receive some storm runoff through sand dunes, fissures in the rock, and so on. But most agree that the rate of recharge for these shallow aquifers is low. There's just not that much water going down there. And for certain deeper aquifers, once you use it, it's gone. Traditional Saudi society has long depended on the groundwater. A significant portion of the population once fed themselves via a network of dry riverbeds called wadi. Rainwater from the monsoons might fill up the wadi or accumulate just beneath the surface, accessible with a shallow well. Nomadic Saudis and their animals traveled these wadi networks, following the rains and foraging whatever grew on the dry beds. And as late as 1970, 20% of the population still lived this way. There are also a few major oases, which for centuries supported small artisanal farms. In one such oasis, Al-Hasa, near the Gulf Coast, there are some alfalfa, rice, vegetable, and sunflower plots. But the vast majority of the farming plots, something like 70%, are date gardens. These gardens are centuries old, small, and family-owned. They provide what had long been Saudi Arabia's only exportable agricultural crop, dates. In 1968, the Saudi government passed an ordinance for distributing fallow public lands to people and organizations. The idea was to expand Saudi Arabia's cultivated lands, transition the country's nomadic peoples to a more sedentary lifestyle, and diversify the economy. However, it became quite clear that more work was needed. In 1961, the country had about 343,000 hectares of total cultivated land. 10-plus years later, in 1973, that had risen to just 373,000 hectares. In 1970, the Saudi government released their first 5-year development plan. The plan called for 4.6% growth in the agricultural sector, but the actual rate fell short. Having been created in the late 1960s, before the dramatic rise in oil prices, the $16 billion budget was simply not enough to do any significant policy. The second development plan, covering the years from 1975 to 1980, saw a dramatic 8-fold increase in scale from $16 billion to $141 billion. Most of that money went into infrastructure, like desalination plants, water transportation, housing, ports, and airports. Between 1975 and 1980, 2,000 new schools were built, 7,400 new hospital beds were added, and 23,000 kilometers of roads were laid down. With oil prices remaining high, the third 5-year development plan further increased the civilian spending budget from $141 billion to $227 billion. The plan also, for the first time, promoted a major shift towards agriculture and food self-sufficiency. The Saudi Minister of Agriculture echoed this shift, saying that, quote, "To produce your own food on your own land, it is a matter of security," end quote. The third plan added substantial new subsidies to encourage agriculture, including a 50% subsidy on fertilizer, a 45% subsidy on farm machinery, and a 50% subsidy on animal feed. Interest-free loans were provided to Saudi farmers. Between 1975 and 1983, 27,000 farmers received 11.8 billion Saudi rials of loans, worth about 10 billion USD today, allowing them to buy and import farming equipment from the United States. What turned out to be most effective, however, were guaranteed purchases of locally grown wheat at very favorable prices. In 1984, the Saudi government bought wheat at $4.72 per kilogram, five times higher than what it was in the rest of the world at the time. The gap was so high that it led to fraudsters trying to pass off wheat imports as being locally grown to get free money. As expected, these policies supercharged the Saudi agricultural sector. In 1980, the Saudis had about 609 hectares of cultivated land, which was about a small 19% increase compared to 5 years prior. By 1985, the amount of cultivated land had leapt up to 946 hectares. Over the same time frame, vegetable production nearly doubled from 756,000 tons to 1.4 million tons. Alfalfa, or green fodder, production grew fourfold to 2.1 million tons. But those categories paled next to cereals, and within that, wheat. Cereals production grew from 268,000 tons in 1980 to 2.2 million tons in 1985. Wheat was over half of that, a huge leap from 1975 when Saudi Arabia produced just 3,000 tons of wheat. In 1984, the Saudis reached wheat self-sufficiency, even producing a small surplus. That year, Saudi Arabia gave Bangladesh 50,000 tons of wheat as food aid. A year later, they started selling wheat to neighboring Gulf countries. The Saudi king talked about being the breadbasket of the Gulf, exporting wheat to Europe and the People's Republic of China. In 1983, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture at the time, John Block, remarked that he thought the program was crazy, implying that it was a waste of money. Those remarks drew a response from the Saudi king himself, who vowed to refute such allegations. The government said it was, quote, a thrilling story of real success, end quote. And I suppose Block was eventually shushed down by the U.S. Secretary of Commerce, who was loving all the U.S. farming machinery exports. But there are a few reasons to agree with Secretary Block's assessment. First, the whole program was costing a lot of money. Contemporary estimates of total investment from 1980 to 1984, when wheat self-sufficiency was reached, was over $18 billion. That is a lot of money for an industry that's just 2% of Saudi Arabia's non-oil GDP. It doesn't make much financial sense to spend $5 on grain that otherwise costs $1 or so to import, even with the oil industry throwing off some $300 billion a year. Second, humans eat more than just wheat. In 1981, Saudi Arabia imported 90% of its food, $1.4 billion worth of animals, including 6 million heads of goats and sheep, 12.1 million chickens, and 252 million eggs, and $2.1 billion worth of vegetable products, including 685,000 tons of corn, 427,000 tons of rice, and 2.3 million tons of barley. What progress were they making on that? In 1984, the Saudi government told reporters that they were almost halfway self-sufficient in chickens, milk, and eggs. Over the rest of the decade, the Saudi chicken industry grew from 140 million birds and 1.8 billion eggs in 1984 to 270 million birds and 2 billion eggs by 1990. Despite this surge in domestic production, even faster growth in chicken consumption meant that the country still had to rely on imports. And in the case of other meats like sheep and cattle, the traditional farms raising those animals relied on older, unoptimized methods. Such methods struggled to scale even with financial incentives. Even if they succeed in those other foods, analysts pointed out that all that had been done was to shift the country's import dependencies from said food products to food inputs, like fertilizers, seeds, and equipment. Third, the policy was not helping to create a large indigenous class of productive farmers. Reporters at the time noted that many of the booming wheat farms were owned by foreigners. Where was the technology and expertise transfer? But to me, the most significant cost was the use of groundwater. The scale of water being withdrawn to irrigate the wheat fields was staggering. Between 1980 and 1984, Saudi farmers installed over 12,000 of these center pivot irrigation systems, mechanized sprinkler systems where crops are irrigated around a center pivot point. It gives you these distinctive looking garden circles. Each center pivot covers up to 200 acres of crops, and during operation can use up to 1,200 gallons of water a minute. In 1980, Saudi Arabia used 1.8 billion cubic meters of water for agriculture, 80% of total demand. 5 years later, agricultural water use had exploded to 7.4 billion cubic meters, or about 1.95 trillion gallons. And where did all of this water come from? Some of it was renewable desalinated seawater, the usage of which expanded from 63 million cubic meters to 400 million cubic meters between 1980 and 1985. But most of the water used for the country's self-sufficiency initiative, over 70%, came out of the ground, 10,000-year-old groundwater that is classified as non-renewable. And yet, despite the water usage and the fact that self-sufficiency in wheat had been achieved, the guaranteed wheat purchasing policies continued throughout the 1980s. To the Saudis, wheat was a strategic commodity, maybe just as important as oil. With it, they nullified any threat of a wheat embargo. And then there was the politics. By the late 1980s, the wheat subsidy program had turned into a government wealth transfer to the rich. Half of wheat production came from 1% of the country's farmers. In other words, the biggest and richest farmers, and they lobbied hard against any potential threat to their position as the top crop. The 1990s saw, finally, a retracing of some of the Saudi agricultural policies. This was for several reasons. The concerns about water sustainability. Oil prices were no longer as high as they used to be, straining government finances. And of course, you had the outbreak of the first Gulf War in 1990. Saudi Arabia played a large financial role in that conflict, putting billions of dollars behind the coalition effort as well as into humanitarian efforts. By then, agricultural water demand had surged to new heights. In 1991, Saudi farms used 23 billion cubic meters of water. That year, the Saudi oil industry pumped 470 million cubic meters of crude. In other words, in 1991, the Saudis pumped 50 times more water than oil out of the ground. And nearly half of all that water was being used to grow wheat. A close second were fodder crops like alfalfa for livestock. Moreover, there was evidence that the five-year plans badly underestimated how much water the farms would use, incorrectly estimating how much cultivated land there was, as well as the per-acre water demand. In 1994, the Saudi government cut the guaranteed price it paid for wheat from 2,000 Saudi rials per ton to 1,500 rials. They also delayed payment delivery by up to 3 years, which caused a lot of smaller farms to drop out. The government also indirectly reset the price of water by tripling the price of diesel fuel, which is used to power the water pumps. These changes in policy had immediate impact on the wheat production totals. In 1992, Saudi Arabia produced 4.1 million tons of wheat, the peak wheat feed. 2 years later, that fell to 2.6 million tons of wheat. The year after that, 1995, production crashed nearly 40% to 1.6 million tons. With consumption at 1.9 million tons, Saudi Arabia was no longer self-sufficient in wheat for the first time since 1984. This remained the case for another decade, with wheat production hovering at just about 80 to 90% of consumption. Then in 2008, the government started phasing out the wheat subsidy programs. The phase-out lasted several years and was finally completed in 2015. That year, the country extracted 17 billion cubic meters of non-renewable groundwater. The country continues to grow other foods domestically like dates, barley, animal fodder, and vegetables. And while they are trying more water-efficient methods like drip irrigation, an unsustainable amount of water is still being pulled up. In 2020, 9.7 billion cubic meters of non-renewable groundwater was pulled. In 1984, the Saudis inventoried their largest groundwater aquifers. They estimated that the aquifers had about 500 billion cubic meters of water, or about 132 gallons. If we take those estimates at face value, though we probably shouldn't, then about half of that was consumed by 1996. When reservoirs get depleted, a few things might happen. The water table either falls further underground, forcing people to drill their wells even deeper, or the water that does come up is saltier, requiring filtering. There is also land subsidence. Removing the water causes the land to sink down and compact together more tightly to fill the void. This subsidence highly depends on local conditions, but can destabilize subsurface cavities, creating fissures and sinkholes. In the end, the most significant thing is that the groundwater cannot be used for some other use. Industrial, residential, with even the largest desalination plants in the world unable to provide enough water for the urban population, the non-renewable well water might be better off being used by the people, rather than being fed to plants that can otherwise be imported. Few can disagree, though, that nations should strive for some form of food self-sufficiency. The reasons for this are starkly obvious. The 2022 outbreak of war in Ukraine disrupted wheat exports, and so Saudi Arabia has restarted their government purchasing programs. Production still trails consumption, but the trend is up. Yet it can be hard to balance these demands with the realities of a country's limited natural resources. And the reality is that much of the water pumped up from the ground, like its oil, will never come back. In the end, what probably works best is something in the middle. More desalination, preferably powered by solar, more water recycling and conservation. In the end, that is probably what closes the gap. What happened with the first Saudi self-sufficiency program should not happen again. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.